Good evening. Thank you for coming to the Hirschhorn Museum. I am Milena Kalinowska, Director of Public Programs and Education, and we will have a wonderful evening with Hal Foster, Princeton University Townsend Marion 17th Professor of Art and History. His talk is entitled, "They Were All Diseased, Distress in Warhol, Early and Late." It is the first of the lectures in our Talk About Andy series. The talk, of course, celebrates the fall exhibition Andy Warhol Shadows, the monumental, extraordinarily well-installed exhibition of 102-part installation which we have on loan from DIA. You probably all know, but just to remind you, this is the first time that all of the 102 works are together. And if I understand correctly, the last 19 works of 102 have never been shown before. I also hope that you will join us for the forthcoming programs on the Warhol. And please, as you may have already done, visit the National Gallery of Art to see another side of Warhol's work, Andy Warhol Headlines. Please visit our website for any other information that you might like to have. I would also like to extend some thanks, first to the National Gallery, particularly to Molly Donovan, Associate Curator, who is here with us, and Deborah Žižka, Director of Communications. They were collaborating with us on the Warhol on the Mall celebration, and it was really their idea to have on the Warhol on the Mall celebration. It was just absolutely fabulous working with them. I also would like to extend our thanks here at the Hirschhorn Museum, of course, first to Evelyn Hankins, Associate Curator, who was responsible for the Warhol exhibition here, which she handled amazingly well. Jenny Leahy, Program Specialist, who worked on all of the programs, and the Talking About Andy series is actually her idea. And Jessica Beck, who works in the Director's Office, whose ideas of all of these three were extremely important for shaping of all of our programs. Now let's move to Hal Foster. As I said, he's at Princeton. He's the department chair of Princeton Art and Archaeology Department. He teaches courses in modernist and contemporary art and theory. He's also an associate member of School of Architecture and Department of German, and works with the Program of Media and Modernity and European Cultural Studies. Among his recent books are Art Since 1900s, Prosthetic Gods, Design and Crime. His forthcoming book, and we have a leaflet about that book at the back, is The First Pop Age, Painting and Subjectivity in the Age of Hamilton, Liechtenstein, Warhol, Richter, and Rocher, which is going to be published by Princeton University Press. It should be coming any time now. And another book is The Art Architecture Complex from Verso Books. Hal Foster is also co-editor of October and writes for Art Forum and the London Review of Books. Hal?
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. My talk is short, so there will be time, I hope, for your comments, and then I have to catch a train. So, as a critic in New York, I grew up with the pictures generation, people like Cindy Sherman and Richard Prince, and Warhol was to us what Pollock was to the generation ahead of us. I mean, he was really a model to watch, to worry about, to work over. And I have to say that I, at least, had no distance from Warhol at that point. And it's only recently that I've come to see him in a new way, because then we just assumed that he was the great creature, but also the great creator of the image world of post-war society, a society of spectacle, consumer society. In other words, that he was just one with this image world, just completely at ease with images. And on to the new relay between image and identity. And that was our view, I think, collectively. And I think this view began to change after his death in 1987. I mean, that was the period of the AIDS epidemic, the period of the attack on the welfare state. It was really the emergence of the full flowering, really, of neoliberalism. So there was, in a way, there was a turn to a world that seemed to resist the idea that everything was simply an image, that had a, if you like, a traumatic view of things. And indeed, in critical theory, there was a turn to trauma discourse. And, you know, as a person who seeks to be current, I was involved in that kind of discussion too. And it's really in this turn to the sense of the traumatic that I began to rethink Warhol. And it happened actually, I'm sorry for the initial anecdote or two, but it happened one day soon after the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh opened. I was actually stuck there because of a snowstorm. And I spent the whole day in the museum, and the art just began to work on me in a new way, in a way that was, for me, unlike any other art. Because it wasn't, my experience wasn't anything really like aesthetic contemplation. But I wasn't really sure what it was. And these are some of the images that I really dwelled upon in the museum that day, or images very much like these. So I began to think about what kind of experience this was. And as I looked at these things over the course of the day, it seemed to me that these pictures were both decomposed as objects and decomposing of subjects, in other words, of the viewer, that they acted on me in a strange new way. They somehow did probe your ruptures. Now, as I thought about this experience, I cooked up this idea of a traumatic realism in Warhol. And it was really this kind of image that made me think in this way. So I felt that there was a register of distress in these works, in the reception of these works. And that register, I suppose, has governed my relation to his art ever since. And so it does again tonight in this talk, which concerns the literal strains to be found in his work, both early and late. And it's fantastic to have this fabulous show that Molly did at the National Gallery of the early headline pieces, and to come here at the Hirshhorn and see the extraordinary shadows all together. So that's the backdrop to this talk. So as you know, according to legend, Warhol broke into his pop style abruptly in early 1962 when he presented two paintings of a Coca-Cola bottle, one still marked by traces of expressivity, such as drips and stains, the other purged of all such signs. He showed them to select friends like Emile D'Antonio, who steered him toward the clean and cool version. But I think this anecdote is misleading. The Warholian image is rarely so simple or secure, and its apparent ease is belied at every turn. Consider the early paintings that foreground the issue of artistic skill, such as the five do-it-yourself canvases of 1962, based on number paintings of banal landscapes and still lives that Warhol appropriated from the Venice of the Venus Paradise Company, a name almost too good to be true. Like a Sunday painter, even a sub-Sunday painter, he laid down the correct colors in the stipulated areas. Yet only one of the patterns, the seascape, qualifies as finished, according to the template. So Warhol's stage is failure, even in this almost robotic kind of picture-making. Moreover, the image appears deteriorated already in his 1960-61 paintings based on newspaper advertisements. Here Warhol drew from cheap ads that hawk, among other products and procedures, hernia supports used in the three versions of Where Is Your Rupture, nose jobs used in the three versions of Before and After, false teeth, wigs and extensions, and corn treatments. Significantly, all these works refer to the vicissitudes of the body and its image, with pain and relief an explicit subject in one work, stop pain exhorts an ad concerning corns, and desire and desirability in another work. An ad showing a couple in evening clothes reads, make him want you. In the context of these paintings, the cosmetic improvement diagrammed in Before and After seems tenuous, to say the least. As you know, Warhol had his nose altered in 1956 and was disappointed by the result. Often in these works, the texts appear as eroded as the images. And this is also the case in the early paintings based on comic strips, such as Dick Tracy of 1960. A mode of breakdown in language as well as in picturing, to which Warhol would return in his last decade. Subsequent images of consumer products painted in shiny black and white are not so distressed, it is true, yet here the chosen items, a turn-of-the-century toilet, a bathtub of the same vintage, a 1928 telephone, a 1936 typewriter, all these from 1961, all these things are out of date, as if nothing could escape outmoding, neither the commodity nor its aesthetic double, the ready-made. And with the toilet and the typewriter, Warhol alludes specifically to two ready-mades by Duchamp. Finally, the distressing of the product is overt in those Campbell's soup cans. This one's from 1962, with torn labels and discolored tins. Given his identification with this commodity in particular, they might be taken as disguised portraits of the damaged artist as no longer so young a man. Early on, Warhol mooted actual harm to the artwork as well. Thematically, damage is suggested in the 15 shipping label paintings, such as Handle with Care, Glass, Thank You, 1962, which point to what they warn against, mishandling and shattering. So too the five Close Cover Before Striking paintings, also of 1962, in which sandpaper bands represent the friction strips on matchbook covers, all but invited viewers to scratch them, and a few were so marked. The seven dance diagram paintings, also of 1962, imply wear and tear as well. In fact, first exhibited flat on the floor, they were susceptible to outright damage. Incidentally, just as the closed covers might be seen to parody the color fields of late modernist abstraction, so the dance diagrams might be taken to mock the aesthetic of the spontaneous and the participatory from Pollock to Happenings. In the same years, Warhol proposed other aggressive measures, such as canvases placed on the sidewalk to be walked on by passers-by, the so-called footprint paintings, or on the studio floor to be urinated on by assistants, the so-called piss paintings, which were resumed in earnest with the oxidation paintings of 1978. I'm never really sure about that first date of those piss paintings. I mean, this might seem academic, But they're represented, as far as I know, in the catalogue raisonné, maybe Molly or James can help me here, only by a photograph. And they could be an urban legend. For art historians, they love the idea that not so long after Pollock, you know, the early 1960s, Warhol would do piss paintings. But the ones we know, for the most part, come from much later, from 1978. And who could forget the so-called cum paintings, a few paintings said to be drizzled with sperm? In the end, I had a lot of dirty canvases, Warhol remarked in retrospect. Then I thought they were all diseased, and so I rolled them up and put them somewhere. For an artist often associated with the sheer superficiality of images, this association not only with active bodiliness, but also with mortal corruption comes, or might come, as a surprise. Warhol was also interested in distress in works by others. For example, in 1970, he curated a show called Raid the Icebox at the Rhode Island School of Design, where he exhibited pictures from the collection that were stained or punctured, and he especially prized some of his Maryland silkscreens that were shot by a factory intruder. So, as you know, Warhol injects smearing and streaking, blanking and washing, flashing and popping in his early silkscreens. But perhaps his key means of distress there is sheer repetition. Serial replication would seem to reinforce the image, not to subvert it. And sometimes, as with the row of 32 individual Campbell soup cans first shown at the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles in July 1962, this is the initial effect. Canned and sealed twice over, as it were, the images appear perfect as both product and display, with each made and presented in the same manner. Yet even here, the redoubling complicates the image, as the singular soups are subsumed by the generic brand, and especially when seriality occurs within a single painting, as in, say, 200 Campbell's soup cans, 1962, more becomes dramatically less as the image approaches the point of abstraction. This is to say that often repetition in Warhol either produces a sameness or releases a difference, and that both can be corrosive of the identity of the image. Sometimes, too, the effect is to obscure the image, literally, as the silkscreen ink thins with repeated use of the screen or blots with uneven application on the canvas. An instance of the former phenomenon of thinning is Elvis Six Times, 1963, in which the figure becomes spectral in the course of its horizontal iterations. And an instance of the latter phenomenon of blotting is Baseball, 1962, the first silkscreen with a photographic template, in which the figure of the batter, repeated 42 times, is blotted out midway through the bottom. The bottom row. A little bit like the Red Sox last night. This deterioration of the image through seriality is not limited to the silkscreens. It begins with stencil paintings like Handle with Care and stamp paintings like Airmail Stamps and SNH Green Stamps, all of 1962, which were produced by means of actual stamps that Warhol carved into art gum erasers applied with paint and then printed on canvas. Just as the flag and target paintings of Jasper Johns are given as flat, so these stamp and stencil images are given as serial. Yet already imprecise as templates, they also vary in repetition. Another type of deterioration is implied here too, a devaluation through counterfeiting. This issue is raised again directly with the very first silkscreens, in which Warhol arrayed his own drawings of dollar bills in different ways on the canvas. Like the stamp paintings, the Bill silkscreens invite us to consider the instabilities of value in images, to question what counts as tender or trust in representation, a topic that also intrigued Duchamp, as we'll see in a second. Finally, the devaluation of the image is also mooted through sheer proliferation. Between 1962 and 1964 alone, Warhol produced some 2,000 paintings, far more than one a day. And his later photographs present an even more extreme statistic. From 1976 to 1986, he exposed on average, a roll of film a day, which amounts to over 100,000 shots. And in the archive at the Warhol Museum, I'm told there are 500,000 items. Besides the aforementioned dancing, walking, and pissing, all procedures that, again, register bodily materiality, even the desublimation of the body, desublimation of the image, Warhol distressed his images through other indexical procedures: blotting, printing, stenciling, stamping, and screening. This predilection for indexical mark-making, really making the sign one with its referent, cuts across the usual divisions of his work into commercial and artistic modes and early, middle, and late periods. In his illustrations from the late 1940s, for instance, Warhol favored the blotted line technique, in which ink is transferred by contact from support to support. And intermittently, he used offset printing from 1953, stamping from 1955, and gold leaf from 1956. So too, in his initial pop work, Warhol developed stenciling, stamping, and silkscreening in rapid succession from February to August 1962, with silkscreening his principal technique thereafter. All these procedures can produce images that are emphatic, even iconic. At the same time, their indexical process often works against this iconic effect. And sometimes resemblance to any referent is lost altogether. Warhol only deepens this indexical distressing of the image in his later work. Produced by sprays and puddles of urine in contact with canvases coated with metallic paint, the oxidation paintings are manifestly indexical, largely automatic or maybe autochemical in process, and mostly amorphous as a result. In his silkscreens of photographs of shadows, the shadow paintings are doubly, even triply, indexical. In the process, the things used to cast the shadows have all but disappeared, the shadow in his studio, and only rarely can they be conjured up from the obscure traces on the canvases. These two series in particular test not only our definitions of representation and abstraction, but our very understanding of what an image is. I'm drawn to the shadows upstairs that you can't see at all somehow. And I thought many things today, but one thing that they are so clearly about, at least for me, is the threshold of visibility and invisibility. I mean, we think about shadows, obviously, as kind of a zone of obscurity. But without shadows, without modeling, there's no figure that is bodied forth in representational painting. So somehow I think Warhol was on to more than just an extraordinary image. We talk about a turn to abstraction in his last decade of work, but that term suggests a stability of picturing that this work does not possess. I think, taken over the entire period, this last decade, his art is really about almost a decreation. Warhol tested the image again and again, and he sustained this testing throughout the late paintings, many of which problematize the distinction between figure and ground that is fundamental to image production and reception alike. Such de-differentiation might be the one common characteristic of these otherwise disparate series, the way they complicate what's a figure and what's a ground. Evident in some shadows and oxidations, de-differentiation is explicit in all the camouflages, this is 1986, where the imbrication of figure and ground exists patently on the canvas. A disruptive oscillation between the two, figure and ground, can also occur in our eyes, as it were, through an optical pulsation affected by color contrasts. Already active in some optical car crashes early on, and flowers too, like this one of 1964, this pulsatile effect is strong in several Diamond Dust Shoes, 1980, where it is produced by the throbbing of the colored high heels on the rich black ground, as well as the dazzle of the diamond dust on the painting surface. It is also in play in some reflected Zeitgeist series paintings of 1982, in which an image of a colonnade of spotlights in the night sky, indeed, it's the notorious Cathedral of Ice designed by Albert Speer for the Nazi Party rally at Nuremberg in 1937, where this image is silkscreened in electric colors on black grounds. In one instance, this one, in three long rows of bright red, yellow, and blue on deep black. The latter two series, the Diamond Dust and the Zeitgeist, even hint at the problematic uses of pictorial bedazzlement in political regimes, whether driven by the American cult of glamour, as in the Diamond Dust paintings, or the Nazi cult of the techno-sublime, as in the Zeitgeist series. And weirdly, I think there's an implicit connection here that is close to Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno in The Dialectic of Enlightenment of 1944. The Diamond Dust Shoes do suggest a kind of holocaust of the glamorous. The two kinds of de-differentiation at issue here, physical and optical, come together in another late series, the Yarn Paintings, 1983, which are scarcely known to this day. I mean, you begin to see them a little more in exhibitions, but for a long time, not at all. Commissioned by a textile company in Florence, the yarns are built up from a single silkscreen of one skein of yarn overprinted multiply on canvas. The results are pulsatile webs that recall the drip paintings of Pollock, though they are never so dense. The favorite colors are also quite different, obviously enough, reds, yellows, oranges, blues, greens, and pinks. Many of the yarns are not large, just a meter or so square, but a few do approach the horizontal extent and immersive scale of the great Pollock drips. And like some drip paintings, some yarns project an optical intensity that flips the impression of plenitude in the image into a sense of scotoma, kind of a blind spot in the viewer. Scotoma is understood by Freud, too, as a condition in which the ego has lost control of the organ of sight. According to Michael Fried, a few Pollock drip paintings, like this one, out of the web, number 7, 1949, where bits of the canvas are literally cut away, according to Fried, these drip paintings produce a kind of blind spot, as if a part of our visual field were also excised, literally, in the process. A few yarns, I think, suggest a related effect, albeit through a scattering of vision more than a blinding. Pulsatile, dazzling, and spread out, such as how Jacques Lacan described the gaze, which he located in the first instance, not in any human subject, not in any person, but in the world at large, in its ambient light, before it is tamed by an image or a screen. Some yarns provoke a similar sort of optical vertigo. This is a stretch, but sometimes when I see these things, they seem to look at me and seem to be almost environmental in this optical gaze that they have. The point of the gaze, Lacan remarked, always participates in the ambiguity of the jewel. And jewels do figure in yet another late series by Warhol, the Gem Paintings of 1978-79. Which are also little known. And again, you begin to see them more and more, but what is it really to see these paintings? The association of jewels and genitals would not be lost on Warhol, who did both drawings and silkscreens of penises. Often large, some are 2 meters wide. Most gems are near monochromes in pale greens and yellows. A cut gem almost fills the canvas, but ambiguously so. It is difficult to determine where it begins or ends, or whether it advances toward us or recedes from us. An ambiguity that is a combined effect of the lustrous light within the image of the jewel and the thin film of diamond dust on the painted surface. Paradoxically, the gems are at once too bright and too obscure to be perceived properly. Their special paint is readily visible only under ultraviolet light. Thus, in the gems, as in the yarns, not only is the image put in distress, but our visual apparatus is also put to the test. I mean, really, what it is to see. This testing suggests a relation to Duchamp, whom Warhol met in Los Angeles in 1963. Where Warhol was in town to show his Elvis silkscreens at Ferris Gallery, Duchamp, to open his retrospective at the Pasadena Art Museum. Of course, like his pop peers, Warhol adapted the Duchampian ready-made to the image, and so prompted questions of originality and authenticity in its sphere as well. Yet a more precise connection emerges between the two. For Duchamp was also interested in the distressed, even diseased, work of art. Consider his specifications for ready-mades, a text collected in the Green Box of Notes, 1934, for the large glass, where in rapid sequence, Duchamp underscores the serial characteristic of the ready-made, then speculates about two other salient possibilities. The first, which he calls the reciprocal ready-made, is an extreme example of the destructive acts staged by Warhol. This is the famous line in which Duchamp writes, "Use a Rembrandt as an ironing board." The second note is more enigmatic. Make a sick picture or a sick ready-made. But both artists, however enigmatic this phrase is, approximated it, this idea of a sick work of art, in their own ways. Like Warhol, Duchamp subjected the art object to various forms of damage. Trompe l'oeil and real, as in Tomb, 1918, where a jagged painted tear is held together with actual safety pins. In a couple of instances, damage effectively became the work, as in Sculpture for Traveling of 1917, in which shreds of colored bathing caps were turned into a cobweb, as Duchamp called it, a cobweb installation that soon disintegrated. An unhappy ready-made of 1919, a wedding present for his sister Suzanne and brother-in-law Jean Croty, that they were asked to create. It was a geometry book, Duchamp remarked of this piece, which he, Croty, had to hang by strings on the balcony of his apartment in the Rue Condamine in Paris. The wind had to go through the book, choose its problems, turn and tear out the pages. Thus exposed, the volume was soon destroyed. There's actually a photograph of the book that just shows its blanched and crumpled paintings, and Suzanne painted it in this state too. More famously, damage was also visited on his Summa, The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelor's Even, 1915 to 1923, which Duchamp declared, as you know, definitively unfinished only after the large glass was badly cracked. It was also subject to another kind of misuse, or rather disuse, as a petri dish for dust breeding, as in the famous Man Ray photograph of this title, where the glass becomes literally smutty. 2 points are key here, at least for me. First, in Duchamp, as in Warhol, this distressing of the object is not separate from its testing. Again, with his stamps and bills, Warhol mooted the question of image deterioration and devaluation, of what counts as tender or trust in representation, which Duchamp also posed with his chunk check of 1919, a handwritten note of payment to his dentist, and his Monte Carlo bond of 1924, which he offered to backers of a system he devised to win at roulette. Second, this testing of the object is not separate from the testing of the subject, again, the viewer. For example, Duchamp pressured our visual apparatus with the pulsatile opticality of his rotoreliefs long before Warhol did the same with his yarns. I also think that both the tear in Duchamp and the rupture in Warhol are related not only to damage in the body ego image, but also to distress and sexual difference. Neither tear nor rupture is far away from what our mothers used to call, or my mother did anyway, our private parts. It is this question of the subject tested subject in Warhol that I want to take up in conclusion. Another nature speaks to the camera rather than to the eye, Walter Benjamin asserts in his essay, Little History of Photography of 1931. And in his treatment of photo booth pictures, this is Taylor Mead, mugshots, this is obviously one of the 13 most wanted men, and publicity images, this is Liz as a MGM starlet, Warhol suggests that different natures also speak to different photographic genres and camera setups. He was especially intrigued by the particular nature that speaks to the movie camera, which is a primary concern of his films. In fact, both the psychological vicissitudes of self-imaging and the technological training of the modern subject are most evident here, and nowhere more so than in his 472 known screen tests produced between 1964 and 1967. So here you just see a shot in the factory of the setup for a screen test. These have become almost familiar now, I think, but again, this is a recent phenomenon. Made with a 16mm Bolex camera on a tripod, each screen test is the given length of a 100-foot roll of film, just under 3 minutes in the shooting, and each was to follow these guidelines, which were often disobeyed. A stationary camera with no zooming in or out, and a centered sitter, face forward, full on the frame, and as motionless as possible. Conceived as filmic portraits, they were initially called stillies. The screen tests are, in effect, photo booth pictures, mugshots, and publicity images rolled into one. And of course, they are not screen tests at all. None was a proper audition for a scripted movie. But they are tests, nonetheless. Indeed, without ulterior motive, they are pure tests of the capacity of the film subject to confront a camera, hold a pose, present an image, and sustain the performance for the duration of the shooting. Each sitter attempts to do so, moreover, not only without the armature of a given character or the benefit of scripted direction, but also under the strain of enjoined immobility and in the midst of ambient distractions. Here's another factory shot of the screen test setup. The subjects are frequently teased, prompted, or otherwise provoked by factory onlookers, and sometimes they are abandoned by Warhol or whoever is nominally in charge of the filming. They're just there before the camera. In short, the sitter has no one truly to interact with, not even in the guise of the camera, which fixed in position offers no reciprocity at all. If there is a scenario here, it is one of an unaided encounter with a technological apparatus, in the blank face of which the lone subject is left to project a self-image as best he or she can. Susan Sontag looks quite composed here, but she looks utterly ridiculous in other screen tests. And if you can discompose Susan Sontag, you can discompose almost anyone, I think. Somehow, we attract people who can turn themselves on in front of the camera, Warhol once commented of his films. In this sense, they really are superstars. It's much harder, you know, to be your own script. I think one of the most capable in terms of being your own script was Baby Jane Holzer. There were several screen tests of Holzer. Yet many screen tests attest precisely to the difficulty of this turning on, this self-scripting, and the sheer duress of filmic iconicity and coherent presence becomes the principal theme, the principal subject of the screen tests. Certainly there is distress at the level of the image. Often the lighting is inconsistent, exposure uneven, and occasionally the image blanches altogether. Also, as in the silkscreens, flashes and pops sometimes occur, and the camera jumps jerkily or zooms abruptly at moments too. Yet there is more distress in the place of the subject, the sitter, in its encounter. I really want to insist on it here, its encounter with the camera. The lighting is frequently harsh, especially on women, which causes some sitters to resort to sunglasses for protection. Others attempt to look away, as if the gaze of the camera might thus be averted. This is Jack Smith, who knew a thing or two about making pictures, making movies. While still others try to stare the camera down. This is John Ashbery, as in the mugshots, as if it, the camera, might blink first, or as if such staring were the best way, maybe the only way, to project and to hold a self-image at all, to keep it intact. The problem is that this staring is often so fixed that it becomes strained in its own way. As in the photo booth pictures, some testees resort to posing or mugging or both, that when histrionic can appear defensive and when aggressive can seem desperate. In short, no matter how self-possessed the sitters might be, and a few were professional actors, many subjects of the screen tests are stricken and exhausted by the process. This is just one of many. This is Anne Buchanan, who tears up throughout the, not even halfway into her screen test. For some sitters, the ordeal was primarily psychological. The screen test, the poet Ron Padgett commented, was like doing an instant Rorschach on yourself. I think that's a fabulous formulation, but I'm not sure really what it means. Imagining your own image, trying to shape it, to project it, to sustain it, and to interpret it all at the same time. For others, the strain was physiological as well as psychological, as if the body image as such were under attack. You sit staring at the camera, the actor Sally Kirkland remarked, and this is she here, and after a while, your face begins to disintegrate. This is a severe testing indeed, and the distress seems to affect men no less than women. Straight, this is Jonas Mekas, no less than gay, this is Mario Montez. I'm almost done. The film director occupies exactly the same position as the examiner in an aptitude test, Benjamin writes in the mid-1930s. And this testing is more difficult, not less, when the director is removed or indifferent, as is the case with many screen tests. And yet, Benjamin continues, the film actor who performs not in front of an audience, but in front of an apparatus, is in a good position to pass the tests, for he or she is trained to address the camera, to win it over, to the advantage even of his or her performance. And as you might expect, one of the people who is able to turn the screen test into a performance is Duchamp. I mean, he really plays with the camera and uses the brilliant device of just smoking a cigar to get through the 3 minutes. According to Benjamin, a primary interest in the movies of his time lay in this technical triumph. The actor was able to turn the apparatus, the camera, to his or her performance. And this was a primary interest in the movies of his time, lay precisely in this technical triumph. Most city dwellers throughout the workday in offices and factories have to relinquish their humanity in the face of an apparatus, on the assembly line, say. This is all Benjamin. Yet in the evening, these same masses fill the cinemas to witness the film actor taking revenge on their behalf, not only by asserting his humanity, or what appears to them as such, against the apparatus, but by placing that apparatus in the service of his triumph. So if they're completely at the mercy of the machine in the factory, Benjamin thinks that the attraction of the film actor is that the actor is, you know, makes the apparatus work for him. The situation of the screen test is very different. Such revenge might be attempted, but it is rarely achieved. The apparatus triumphs over the sitter far more often than the reverse, and there is no humanist redemption in the face of the camera, no redemption of the human. And for the most part, the viewer has little choice but to associate sadistically with this machine vision or to identify masochistically with the film subject under its power. At times, the latter option seems almost the only common ground of humanity here, that, again, we're all under the power of different apparatuses. In fact, in Warholian cinema at large, to film a person often meant to provoke and or to expose him or her, and to be filmed meant to parry this probing, or to be laid bare by it, or not. I mean, there were a few who could resist. As a result, the viewer cannot idealize the film person, as is usually the case with Hollywood cinema. One can only empathize intermittently with his or her travails before the relentless camera. That is, again, to empathize with the vicissitudes of the subject becoming an image, with wanting this condition too much, resisting it too much, or otherwise failing at it. Now, I became fascinated by not just the distressing in Warhol, but the testing in Warhol, because I think he was on, early on, to a phenomenon that has become absolutely pervasive. I think we'd really live in a test society, and younger people even, you know, far more than people my age, tested again and again. Obviously, this has to do with the tooling and retooling that the economy demands as it shifts. But I mean, for me, what we count as reality TV, and of course Warhol is one of the great founders of reality TV, is really test TV. What will people do under the camera? Will they hold it together? Will they keep it together? And let me just end with a shameless plug for my new book on pop, which has a chapter on Warhol, but also on Hamilton, Liechtenstein, Richter, and Rocher. It's a book that really argues that there is such a thing as a pop subject, a subject defined as an image, kind of a homo imago. That this was an insight of pop and Warhol above all, that the person is very much like an image. And the ego is, first of all, as Freud told us, a projection of an image. But even more importantly, the image is a person, or like a person, and can be animate, can be an animate agent. And I think this this relay between image and subject, image and person, is a key one, obviously, in Warhol. And in my early days, in part because of the pictures milieu, I thought Warhol just swam in it as his element. But more and more, I've seen how he, from early on, he explored the difficulty of what it is to be homo imago, a person that's also an image, and that one is often in distress in that condition. It's a bit of a bummer way to end, but that's where I end. Thank you. If you have no comment or question or whatever, I'm happy to. Yeah. Maybe, can we have the lights up a bit? I know it's also the second night of Rosh Hashanah, so if you're out of here, you're out of here. See you, James. Shoot, please.
I was thinking of the connection between screen tests that aren't really screen tests and Cindy Sherman's film stills that aren't really film stills, and sort of the discomfort they create, particularly among, I know film critic friends of mine absolutely despise the film stills for not looking like film stills, and it seems that's kind of the point, that in cases you've sort of taken this Hollywood apparatus and reduced it to two people, one on side of the camera. I wonder if the sort of downsizing of that apparatus, I don't know where you're going with this, but
I think that's that's perfect, because it never occurred to me, really never had, but you're absolutely right. There is that connection, and the pieces by Cindy Sherman are all about the difficulty of image fashioning. I mean, how to become that image. And it used to kill me. It still does, actually, when critics, now historians, want to track down the film noir or the B movie that Sherman, might or might not have used as an inspiration, because that's just not the point at all. It's really, as you say, precisely about what it is to be an image and how often to fail. I mean, there's a fabulous very early, I think it's number two, entitled Film Still. And there are more that involve mirrors, but the one that I have in mind is this blonde. I mean, it's bobbed blonde, and she, the photograph shows her, it seems to be in her bathroom, at her, just in front of her cabinet, and her mirror is there, and you kind of sense the gap between her body and her desired image, the image that she wants to see in the mirror. And I think again and again, the film stills really about that gap between your actual body and your ideal image of your body, and just the, you know, the difficulty there. But it, you know, till you mentioned it, I had never thought about it. I mean, this is what's. I won't ramble on any further, but I've just begun to teach a course that's based on this book for the first part, and then moves on to the pictures generation, and then on to questions of media and market and the present. And I've never taught the material that my wife and I grew up with in New York, because I just never had any distance on it, and I still don't really, because that's a connection I should have made years ago. You know, it's really tricky how things come into focus or how they don't, you know. Anyway. Oops, sorry. Shoot. Josh.
I was just going to ask if you would be interested or willing to write this very graphic and awesome, what you're saying. Because it seems to me that there's something like a loose consensus that the way to understand Warhol and subjectivity is sort of aligned a little bit with part of those essays, to say there's kind of an attack on essentialism and pop and identities. Mm-hmm. So, but it seems to me there's been a lot of little growth in film stills in the last year or two, probably, I suppose, this is another show. But one of the things that I think your talk brought out really nicely in the last few minutes is that film stills, the screen shots, do a really wonderful job of putting pressure on the simplicity of that model.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you. I mean, I don't know if you view that, if you think there's a consensus of that kind, but whether you would say that what you're trying to articulate in this talk, and I'm taking the book too, is some kind of revision of this story about what Warhol's version of subjectivity is. You know, the subjectivity,
yeah.
Postmodern subjectivity is, its relationship to the kind of essential self.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's like the first question. Take that and tape it into my book. So if you buy it, you can email me and I will refer you to these, Josh and you. And that's it exactly. I mean, that's what I meant at the beginning, that the, you know, as a young critic, I was so under the sway of very strong models, readings of Warhol in particular. I think, you know, many people were, and it really was in part, you know, drawn from statements of Warhol. I mean, you can pick and choose what you want, but it was all about that, you know, there's, look at me, look at my work, it's all image, there's nothing behind it. And of course, you know, Roland Barthes wrote a beautiful essay in 1980 that developed this idea of the pop images simulacral, and I think that did become, you know, absolutely essential to the anti-essential nature of postmodern art, postmodern theory. There was a counter, of course, that wanted to think about Warhol in terms of his own historical moment. There was a social historical counter. Maybe you'd be more sympathetic with that line, and that was associated with Tom Crowe, as you know, wrote a terrific piece called Saturday Disasters, in which he almost read the death and disasters, you know, the car wrecks and the race riots and the tuna fish poisonings as, and the electric chairs, really as history paintings, in effect. And as I fell out of love with the Barthian reading, I didn't totally fall in love with the Crowean reading. And so I wanted to find another way that also spoke again to subjectivity. And that's really where I developed this idea of the traumatic in Warhol. But even there, I think I was too taken by my own model and kind of used the model to drive the work rather than the reverse. You know, because it was hard to see the screen tests. Callie Angel, she did an extraordinary job in her as you went through so many and they began to be seen more and more. It was precisely that. The performative subject was undone before your eyes as you watched these things. Even the most accomplished scene makers, just melted before the camera more often than not. And I'm still not sure if I really got what's on there, but it is a different kind of subjectivity for sure. Anybody else? Shoot.
Do you think that the sexual flip-flopping that both Duchamp and Warhol did, image-wise, plays into your theme?
Yeah, I mean, that. I do, mention that sexual difference has to be, if you want to talk about the difficulty of what it is to be a subject, a person, sexual difference has to be involved. And I don't think in this talk I've pressured it enough. But one thing that did strike me about the film stills, I mean the screen test, and I've seen, not 472, but I've seen hundreds, is that these pressures seem to strike people or felt by people across lines of gender, across lines of sexual difference, of sexual performance. That and this is why I said at the end that there seems to be, if there is a humanity in the world of Warhol, it seems to be a humanity that's a modern one under stress, a tested subject. And how one reacts, of course, would differ according to gender and sexuality. But weirdly, that's not often seen in the film stills, right? I haven't, or the screen test, or at least I haven't detected it as much. It's certainly there in the film stills, and that's I think where there is a kind of critique in the pictures, at least some of the pictures artists of Warhol, and certainly in the Warhol scholarship. People like Douglas Crimp and Richard Meyer become much more attentive to the reception of Warhol in terms of gender and sexuality. Anybody else? Shoot.
I'd like to ask you if you could elaborate further on sort of the interaction between the artist or the artistic team in the factory and Warhol. And society, how the artist affected society, whether that was intentional or not, and also how society affected the artist.
That's a huge question. On the one hand, I think you can see the factory as a late bohemian setup that really does want to be apart from at least bourgeois society. On the other hand, it's the moment when that collapses altogether, if it ever were, a real model. Because, of course, Warhol becomes the great media artist. And I think this is quite conscious. I think it's hard to speak generally for all the different people that passed through that scene. I think many people wanted just to get out of their families, out of society in a way. But others wanted to get right into society, into another kind of society. Right into the art world, right into media world, fashion world, film world, and so on. So, that's about all I can say. Did Warhol set out to have a huge social effect? Absolutely he did. absolutely. But, you know, I have to say that, you know, I was in New York for the last decade of his life, and you would see him around everywhere, and, you know, it was a little pathetic, actually, because he didn't... he had this importance. He was already his own brand. In fact, that became his work. You know, he called it business art to sell his brand. But he didn't seem to have much effect, at least in my version of the art world then. Again, maybe because he was too close, or we already took him so much as a model. But I just wish if I had, you know, $500, I'd gotten one of those little paintings that are now worth like $5 million. But, you know, who had $500 back then? Shoot.
Could you say just a little more about your choice of the term distress?
Uh-huh.
Because you seem to use it in multiple senses. There's a kind of psychological distress.
Mm-hmm.
Throws maybe out of your work on trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a kind of economic distress and a sense of obsolescence.
Yeah.
I couldn't help thinking about distressed genes. And capitalism sells us things that have been deliberately broken down and made to seem wrecked as a commodity.
Right.
And I wonder whether Warhol even sensed that in advance.
Yeah, That's a good one. I don't know. On the one hand, you know, the statements are all about a horror of distress. You know, everything has to be new. But the works are so distressed. I mean, I chose the word, you know, I thought about many words. And basically the argument of the book is that the five artists that I deal with invent a new kind of image for this question of homo imago, of man as image as person. And I thought about ruptured image. But distress, as you say, it has all these different resonances. It's not only physical. It's not only psychological. It has, you know, one speaks, as you say, of economic distress. So in a way, it's not really a concept, I don't think. It's a description that slides across these different registers in a way that I think the work does too. But I think you can become, at least I can become, so captive to a way of thinking that it took me just so long to see how strained these works were, just as objects, but also how strained they were as they affected viewers like me. So, you know, I could do more, I think, with the concept. Anybody else? Or one more, maybe? Shoot.
I wanted to know your comments on Warhol's relationship, both like as commentary, but as his like context, like cultural context, with time and permanence, because
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of commentary about how many of the people he made art with just aren't with us anymore,
right?
Both personally and just in the general culture.
It's a great. It's a great point. I mean, it's a great conundrum time in Warhol because pop in general is defined in its first moment by Richard Hamilton as about the ephemeral. And Warhol was all about the transitory, you know. But he also wanted to keep the transitory. You know, he has all these time capsules. So, and, you know, his famous fear of death, and that was actually an extraordinary thing, and I mentioned it just as I began to speak, that part of this turn in my view of Warhol, and I think others too, was really about the absolute inescapability of death in New York in the 1980s, especially in the art world, especially in the gay art world. And there is a way in which the dream of Warholian pop that we all will live forever as an image, even if we're only famous for 15 minutes, that just was blown away by the period. And I think there's a reason why so many of his suites of paintings in the last decade are quite literally dark, you know, really about the kind of breakdown of figure and ground, breakdown of the form, breakdown even of the visible. Yeah, it's a great subject. I mean, I think in this book I want to argue that the pop artists were like the last artists in that great Baudelairean project of the painting of modern life, the representation of modern life. And you remember Baudelaire says that modern art is about two things. It has two halves that don't necessarily add up. One is about the ephemeral. If you're a modern artist, you paint modern life. But the other is the eternal, the epic. You know, that out of the ephemeral, you capture, if not the transcendental, you capture what will remain of this moment. And I think Warhol, for all his attention to the party tonight or the event tomorrow, he was able to rest out of the absolutely ephemeral, the most extraordinary history paintings, if you like, of the time. So, but it's a great question, because time really is a conundrum in Warhol. But time is a conundrum too, for me, and I got to hit the road. So thank you for coming.